This is June Singer, June 1980, Religious Functions of the Self.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, June 18th, 1980. June Singer here. I'm speaking on the subject, the religious function of the self. I believe this morning, Dr. Vasavada introduced you to the concept of the self as it relates to the ego. I will be concentrating more on the self. However, it's difficult to speak about the self without speaking about the ego, although most psychologists are perfectly capable of speaking about the ego without speaking about the self. That seems to be standard. It's only Jung who speaks about the self with a capital S, while many others speak about the self with a small s, a sort of self-psychology, about which you hear a great deal today, but that really refers to an aspect of ego, and we'll touch on that later. But when I talk about the self in Jungian terms, the archetypal self, I'm using, and you can imagine, a capital F, which sets that self apart from the common usage of the self, which is almost coexistent with ego. The difficulty of the subject, I must say, awes me. I spoke with Sharon just a minute ago, and I said I don't want to track over the same material that Dr. Vasavada covered, and Sharon said very sweetly, well, he didn't exhaust the subject. My answer to that was, Jung didn't exhaust the subject either. So I think there will be a whole lot to say about the self as we conceive it in Jungian psychology and as it's conceived in other disciplines, particularly religious disciplines. I've been reflecting on this question of what is the self and how do I come into a relationship, a conscious knowing relationship with the self, for about 20 years, for just 20 years ago that I first went to the Jung Institute in Zurich, 1960. And there I began to experience the coming alive of concepts that I had read about and thought about, and I stress the about, because experiencing and feeling is very different from reading about. And so I guess today I'm still trying to understand what the self is, and the difference is that 20 years later, after my introduction to it, I recognize that I can never fully understand it, but that I am on the path. And I know from your presence here that you also are on the path, that you are moving in a direction which is transpersonal and beyond ego. And we're all on that path. Some of us may be a little bit farther along. Some of us have not been at it so long. But it reminds me of the guru who was asked, are you on the way? And the guru said, yes, I am, to his student. And the student said, well, may I join you? But I hesitate to ask because you are so far along and I'm just a beginner. And the guru very wisely responded, when the path is a path to infinity, it doesn't make a lot of difference if you're a half an inch farther along or not. So that's where we are. We're all inching our way on a very long road. I want to tell you about, to tie in with what Dr. Vasavada might have said this morning, before Dr. Vasavada came to Chicago, I went to visit him in India. And he introduced me to my first experience in a Hindu temple. This was not one of those great temples that are there and used for show, that people come and look at the sculpture, but this was an ordinary, everyday temple where the Hindu people go to worship. I was quite interested to find out how the worship service, if there was one, carried on. So we went, first we took off our shoes and went into a meditation room where everyone was seated for a while, reflecting inwardly, coming to an inner quiet place within themselves. And then it was time to go in, and by some unseen signal, somebody got up and we all got up and moved into the temple proper. Now, the temple had a kind of altar, stage sort of thing, that was marked off by grillwork, a sort of that rail. And behind that was a platform on which were seated three very beautiful statues, gods, I assume. One was female and the other two were male. And they were dressed in three silk gowns covering them, and they had beautiful jeweled necklaces and fancy elaborate headdresses, and it was really quite impressive. And then I watched, people were moving in that direction, but the group with whom I was went to the back over to the left-hand side and sat down and paid very little attention. They didn't even bother to bow before the images. But they joined together and began to read from the Upanishads. And I was sitting there. Of course, I didn't understand it. It was all in Hindi. But one person would read a passage, and then the others would discuss quite animatedly the meaning of the words and their understandings of it. And while this was going on, there were other people who would come into the temple and go up to the rail and stand before the gods and goddesses and sprinkle something I took to be holy water and perhaps throw a few flowers in that direction and would prostrate themselves before these images and mutter something for a while and then retreat. I was kind of interested in this because I did know a little bit about the Upanishads, and I knew that they were not particularly theistic. They were more centered about a kind of unified central image of what I was to understand later was the self, while the images on the altar were multiple. And I thought to myself, now how is this that this bunch of people is sitting philosophizing and trying to understand meaning while the other group is involved with these multiple images? And then I thought, it's kind of interesting because in our Jungian psychology, we also center around the image of unification, the image of the self, the image of one archetype, which is an overriding archetype under which all the others are subsumed and of which the others are manifestations. And then we have a group of people who have Jungian backgrounds who call themselves archetypal psychologists and who are much more interested in the multiplicity and attached to the concern with individual gods and goddesses. So I thought, well, if the religion of Hinduism has room for both of these approaches and individuals can determine for themselves which approach is more compatible for them, I guess there's a parallel here that we can all begin to understand. The concept of the self and the concentration of the, upon the self, I think was one of Jung's most important contributions, and I do believe that in the future, when psychology has moved beyond where it is today, and philosophy has moved beyond where it is today, and religious expressions have moved beyond where they are today, that Jung's understanding of the self will hold a very important place in the minds of human beings. Jung's concept of the self came from the Indian idea of the self as an unchanging entity, Atman, is what the expression is for this entity. But the entity, the unchanging entity, Atman, is in a changing body. The self, then, is one with Brahman, the divine essence, which is not manifest. Now, what do we mean by not manifest? Invisible, inexplicable, not belonging to any particular faith or creed, something which is essential and infinite and eternal, and yet which cannot be perceived by the human intellect, because the human intellect is limited. And this unchanging entity, the self, is unlimited. So it isn't manifest. However, there are manifestations. Now, the self is identified with Atman in this as an unchanging entity. But there is also a self, an individual self, and this is identified also with Atman. But here we mean with the small a, and the Hindus evidently make the same distinction, we mean the individual self is identified with that essence within us which we perceive as a divine principle, the indwelling Godhead, if you will, so that the individual self, or it could be also ego, depending on whose terminology you're using, is identified with the body senses. That's one part of it. It's also identified with the individual mind. And thirdly, it's identified with prana. Now, prana, again, prana, which is identified with the individual, which is what we experience, is the breath within the breath. That is the spiritual quality which inspires. And I just don't mean carbon dioxide and nitrogen and all that stuff, whatever it is we breathe, but the essence in that breath which gives life and sustains life. And that is the humanly experienced part of prana with a large P, which means cosmic energy. That is the life force which permeates the universe. So these are the constituent parts of the individual's experience of the self: the body senses, the mind, and prana. Now, I want to read something. I brought you an armful of books. And I feel that if we are to understand what this is all about, it's a good idea to perceive it through the language of the people who originated it. And so I want to read you a passage from the Upanishad, which tells us something about how the Indians felt about prana, the breath. And to give you a preface, it appears that the various parts of the human organism were arguing among themselves as to which was the most important. And prana, the vital breath, was the oldest and considered itself the greatest. The organ of speech was another. The attribute of steadiness, which is dependent on the eye and balance, was another. The ear was another. The mind was another, and semen was another, the attribute of procreation. So all of these elements were arguing among themselves as to who was the most superior. And so they went to Prajapati, who was the lord of creation, and asked, "Which among us is the most excellent?" And he said, "That one among you is the most excellent, by whose departure this body is considered to suffer the most." The organ of speech departed. After being absent for a whole year, it came back and said, "How have you been able to live without me?" The other organ said, "Oh, we live just as dumb people live, without speaking through the tongue, but living through the vital breath, seeing through the eye, hearing through the ear, knowing through the mind, and procreating through the organ of generation." Then the organ of speech re-entered the body, and the eye departed. After being absent for a whole year, it came back and said, "How have you been able to live without me?" The other organ said, "We live just as blind people live, without seeing through the eye, but living through the vital breath, speaking through the organ of speech, hearing through the organ of hear, knowing through the mind, and procreating through the organ of generation." The ear went out. After being absent for a whole year, it came back and said, "How have you been able to live without me?" The other organ said, "We live just as deaf people live, without hearing through the ear, but living through the vital breath, speaking through the organ of speech, seeing through the eye, knowing through the mind, and procreating through the organ of generation." The mind went out, and the same procedure, and also the organ of generation went out. And when it came back, the other organ said, "We live just as impotent people live, without procreating children through the organ of generation, but living through the vital breath, speaking through the organ of speech, seeing through the eye, hearing through the ear, and knowing through the mind." So the organ of generation re-entered the body. Then, as the vital breath was about to depart, it uprooted the organs from their places, just as a great noble horse of the country tears up the pegs to which its feet are tied. They said, "Venerable sir, please do not go out. We shall not be able to live without you." "If I am such, then give me an offering." "So be it." The organ of speech said, "The attribute of being most excellent which I possess is yours." The eye said, "That attribute of steadiness which I possess is yours." The ear said, "That attribute of prosperity which I possess is yours." The mind said, "That attribute of being an abode which I possess is yours." The organ of generation said, "That attribute of procreation which I possess is yours." Then the vital breath said, "If I am such, then what will be my food and what will be my dress?" They replied, "Whatever food there is, including that of dogs, worms, insects, and moths, will be your food, and water will be your dress." He who knows the food of the vital breath to be such never happens to eat anything or accept anything that is not food. Wise men who are versed in the Vedas therefore take a sip of water just before and after eating. They think thereby to remove the nakedness of the vital breath. So that gives you an idea of the importance of the cosmic energy within the experience of the human being. And I think at this point I'm going to... See, there's one more passage I wanted to read to you. In which Prajapati is again asked to explain what is the meaning of the self by a student. The student happened to be the god Indra, who before the Lord of all creation was learning still. Prajapati answered Indra, "I shall explain the self further to you and nothing else. Live with me for another 5 years." This was after Indra had been living with Prajapati for I don't know how many years, trying to learn about the self and still hadn't encompassed it. By the way, I'm not going to keep you 5 years here. We're going to have to get as much as we can this afternoon. But in India and in this way of thinking, time is really not a consideration. So Indra lived with Prajapati another 5 years. That made in all 101 years. Therefore, people say that Indra lived with Prajapati as a student 101 years. Then Prajapati said to him, "O Indra, this body is mortal, always held by death. It is the abode of the self, which is immortal and incorporeal. The embodied self, that's with a small s, is the victim of pleasure and pain. So long as one is identified with the body, there is no cessation of pleasure and pain. But neither pleasure nor pain touches one who is not identified with the body. The wind is without body, and thunder without body. Now, as these arising from yonder and reaching the highest light appear in their own forms, so does the Supreme Being arising from this body and reaching the highest light appear in his own form. In that state, he is the highest person. There he moves about, laughing, playing, rejoicing, be it with women, chariots, relatives, never thinking of the body into which he was born. As an animal is attached to a cart, so is the prana attached to the body. And here, the prana is also used synonymously with the unconscious self. That's the individual self. So you see the relationship, or you get a sense of the relationship of individual self as it's experienced by human beings and cosmic self, which we cannot experience directly, but only through its manifestation. Now, what I'm going to do is to take a little break here, perhaps for some questions, and then resume and tell you about some other parallels, because while Jung may have gotten his basic concepts from the Hindu mythology, there are other places where we see something quite similar in other religions, and I'd like to share those with you. So before I go on to other expressions of this concept that we are trying to deal with, and at the moment it is a concept, we're talking about it, perhaps you have some questions or some comments or some feelings that you want to share, and I'd be open to that. Yes, please. Would I like to speak to just what the relationship of the small A Atman and the large A Atman? That's a parallel to the ego, which would correspond to the experience of the self and the individual, and the self as we speak of it in Jungian psychology as related to the cosmic self principle in Hinduism. So I think there's the parallel there should be quite clear. Does that help any, or is there a further question that you have? I think that Jung took his concept of ego pretty much from his relationship with Freud and his concern with the psychologies that were current in those days, but that when he began to recognize that the unconscious was a lot more than just what was repressed from conscious life, he began to get into the cosmic, the transpersonal dimension, and he then found the parallel in Hinduism for the idea of the self, which he didn't get from any of the contemporary psychologies, as far as I know. So when he understood the self, Atman, equivalent, then he recognized that the ego was also related to the Hindu concept of Atman with a small a as a personal experience of the large Atman. Does that explain that? Please. The self with the large S is, of course, an archetype. And it has, or it manifests itself in many images. So that the way that we perceive with the small s, the way the ego perceives those images, belongs to the ego functioning. However, and there's a little shady area here, because when you talk about an image like the divine child, for example, that's not a personal image, but it's only personal, it only becomes personal, or is experienced as personal when it appears in an individual's dreams, or when one identifies one's own behavior or functioning with that particular archetype. So the images are the, I would say, the intermediaries between the archetypal and the personal. Please. Mm. Yes. Yeah. You're absolutely right in stating that it would be less confusing if we only talked about the self in the terminology that relates to the Atman or the Brahman principle. However, and it is confusing to have this personal self, but I purposely brought it in just because it is confusing, because Jung is not always very clear about it either. If you read Jung, you recognize that his concepts developed, and at times he talks about the self with a little less, and other times he talks about the ego, and you're not quite sure of the differentiation. And then currently, too, there's this whole school of self-psychology with Kohut and Kernberg and all those people who talk about this self, and that's the self with a little S. So I think it's, for me, the best way to differentiate is to recognize that when we're talking about the cosmic principle, that we capitalize it. But I see the problem. It was a problem for me, too. Yes, and it is invisible. In experience, we experience the images, which are manifestations, but the archetype itself is invisible and incomprehensible. Yes. Yes, see. Right. That's correct. Yes, indeed. Well, it's other. It's experienced as other. And yet, if you have a concept of the world as an interconnected and interrelated unity, there really isn't any other. And not in a lot of contemporary Western thought, too, particularly, and I'm going to touch on this a little later, contemporary quantum physics, when the interconnected network of everything is perceived or is understood, with everything influencing everything else, that we don't anymore conceive of ourselves as isolated in a bag of skin with everything outside of ourselves being other. But we really see that membrane as that which connects us to everything that isn't us. So it's a very different way of looking at it. And there, in a sense, it's other, because we perceive ourselves as integrated ego cells with a small s. But in another sense, when we can transcend the personal and get into a transcending, a transpersonal dimension, then it's not other at all, because we are part of it and it is part of us. Yeah, sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. And I think that will become clearer as we go on. Ellen? What you've raised is a very important issue, and I do intend to touch on it a little later when I get into contemporary issues. But it's quite true, as you pointed out, that Western thought tends to emphasize a linear sequential thinking and therefore a historical mode, while traditional Eastern thought tends to be more cyclic and holistic. I think that this has been true for a long time, that the United States has been influenced by Europe, but that recently, since the 50s and 60s, and even more today, the influence of the East has been increasing. And here, then, we have a meeting of East and West, and we're right now in a kind of struggle. With respect to the narcissistic development, in quotes, you know, I think that that is one of the negative aspects of inward looking. I think people can get very inward looking and forget there is an outward out there. But the people are really concerned with themselves in context, as I understand it, and the people that, many people by whom I'm influenced, have gone through the narcissistic phase and really experienced it, and if you want to call it that, to their own personal inner work and analysis, and are now coming out the other side of it and beginning to see themselves individuated and yet very much interdependent with the ecological system of which they're a part. So it seems like you first have to know yourself and recognize yourself before you can get beyond that. And this is what I think is happening. I think that we here are a part of that very movement, people who have been interested in introspection and now come to consider issues of the self which go beyond, way beyond the personal. So I appreciate you bringing that up, Ellen. I think it's a very germane question. Well, I'd like to go on a little bit now for about a half an hour, and then we'll take a break and continue later. This first session of the two that we'll have today is going to deal mostly bringing us up to Jung. And then afterward, I want to begin to speculate with you where we go in and through and beyond Jung, which, of course, is pure speculation, but there's a lot of thought in this area. The Jewish tradition, of course, is linear, sequential in its orthodox form. It has a very great sense of historicity. But the Kabbalistic tradition, the mystical tradition within Judaism, takes quite a different view. And as the Hindus sat among themselves and discussed the meaning of the Upanishads, the line by line and word by word, the old rabbis used to do the same thing in the ghettos of Warsaw and Spain and wherever they were. And it was all kind of fascinating to me because there are the same questions coming up in such a different context, and this shows us how archetypal this issue is, this issue of the ultimate reality, ultimate truth, the great ultimate. It seems here again there's always a student who may be very great but is lesser than the master. And this student in the Zohar, which is a translation of Kabbalistic literature, this student was Rabbi Eliezer, and he was pronouncing on what he thought was the case to be with the eternal mysteries. This is what they used to do on Saturday afternoon, because Saturdays they weren't allowed to work. All of these rabbis were butchers and bakers and whatever. But on Saturday they would go to the synagogue or to somebody's house, and they would get into these marvelous arguments about the nature of God and other things that would take them completely out of their everyday activity. So Eliezer was holding forth, and Rabbi Simeon, who is the great wise man, says, Eliezer, son of mine, cease thy discourse, that there may be revealed higher mysteries which remain sealed for the people of this world. Rabbi Eliezer then fell into silence. Rabbi Simeon wept a while and then said, Eliezer, what is meant by the term these? I better write this for you. What what is meant by the term these? Surely not the stars and the other heavenly bodies, since they were always visible and were created through Ma. As we read, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made. That's Psalm 33, if you recall. Nor can it imply things inaccessible to our gaze, since the vocable these obviously points to things that are revealed. This mystery remained sealed until one day whilst I was on the seashore. Elijah came to me and said, Master, what means me, who created these? So, what means who created these? I, this is Rabbi Simeon speaking, said to him, Elijah, that refers to the heavens and their hosts, the works of the Holy One, blessed be he, works to the contemplation of which man comes to bless him, as it is written, when I behold the heavens, the work of thy fingers, O Lord our God, how glorious is thy name in all the earth. Then he, Elijah, said to me, Master, the Holy One, blessed be he, had a deep secret, which he at length revealed to the Celestial Academy. It is this. When the most mysterious wished to reveal himself, he first produced a single point, which was transmuted into a thought, and in this he executed innumerable designs and engraved innumerable gravings. He further graved within the sacred and mystic lamp a mystic and most holy design, which is a wondrous edifice issuing from the midst of thought. This is called me, and was the beginning of the evidence, edifice, existence and non-existence, deep buried, unknowable by name. It was only called me, which means who. It desired to become manifest and to be called by name. It therefore clothed itself in a refulgent and precious garment and created Eleh, thee. And Eleh acquired a name. The letters of the two words intermingled and formed the complete name, Elohim. Which means God. When the Israelites sinned in making the golden calf, they alluded to this mystery in saying, Eleh, these are thy gods, O Israel. And once me became combined with Eleh, the name remained for all time. And upon this secret, the world is built. And you'll recognize now, it's kind of interesting, that Elohim is a plural noun. I referred to this in my book, Androgyny, and this is another aspect of that whole mystery, that we talk of the Godhead, the most mysterious, in pluralistic language. Then Elijah flew away and vanished out of my sight, and it is from him that I became possessed of the profound mystery. Now, Rabbi Eliezer and all his companions came and prostrated themselves before him, weeping for joy, saying, if we had come into the world only to hear this, we should have been content. The Rabbi Simeon said further, the heavens and their hosts were created through the medium of Ma, which means what? The Hebrews are very fond of riddles. As it is written, when I behold thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, O Lord our God, Ma is glorious, Ma, glorious is thy name in all the earth, whose majesty is rehearsed above the heavens. God is above the heavens in respect of his name, for he created a light for his light, and one formed a vestment to the other, So he ascended into the higher name. Hence, in the beginning, Elohim, God, created. That is, the supernal Elohim. Whereas Ma was not. So, that is the what, meaning the created world did not exist, nor was it built up until these letters, Elek, from Elohim, were drawn from above down below. And the mother lent her daughter her garments and decked her out gracefully with her own adornment. That's very interesting, because the idea of the God above was, in a sense, masculine, and almost in a sense. But when creation comes into being, it is the mother and her daughter, the material world, material, mater, mother, it's all the same root. The material world is conceived of as the feminine aspect or the manifestation of the masculine God. Now, so the mother lent the daughter her garments and decked her out gracefully with her own adornment. When did she adorn her so? When all the males of Israel appeared before her in accordance with the command, all thy males shall appear before the Lord God. This term, Lord, is similarly used in the passage, behold the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and so on. Thus it says, thee, Elek, I remember. I make mention with my mouth and pour out my tears. I make them, the letters, lift them on high unto the house of Elohim. And with what? With the voice of song and praise amid a festive throng. Well, I've led you through a kind of tangled web here, but I hope you'll get a sense of the idea of the non-manifest concept which filled the whole creation, and finally withdrawing into himself and producing this ray or this point, which then becomes the created world. The Ella, what, Ma, and who, me? Me is, of course, the unknowable self, and that is corresponds to the Atman. So, that gives you some idea of the Hebraic parallel. The Rig Veda is another place where the spirit of the oneness, the self, comes forth. And here I want to share with you something really very beautiful. It's hymns from the Rig Veda. Some of you may have seen this book. It has some really magnificent photographs in which we get a sense of the majesty of the concepts. The hymn of creation is prefaced by this photograph of heaven and earth and this tremendous presence. And the words go like this. Neither non-being nor being was as yet, neither was airy space nor heavens beyond. What was enveloped and where, sheltered by whom? And was there water, bottomless, unfathomed? Neither was there death nor immortality, nor was there any sign then of night or day. Totally windless by itself, the One breathed. Beyond that, indeed, nothing whatever was. Now, I'm going to read on. I want you to pick up the masculine and feminine elements of the Godhead. In the principle, darkness concealed darkness. Undifferentiated surge was this whole world. The pregnant point, covered by the form matrix from conscious fervor, mightily brought forth the One. In the principle, masculine, as you realized, thereupon rose desire, which of consciousness was the primeval seed. Then the wise, searching within their hearts, perceived that in non-being lay the bond of being. Stretched crosswise was their line, a ray of glory. Was there a below? Was there an above? There were sowers of seeds and forces of might, potency from beneath, and from on high the will. Who really knows? Who could here proclaim whence this creation flows? Where is its origin? With this great surge, the gods made their appearance. Who therefore knows from where did it arise? This flow of creation, from where did it arise? Whether it was ordered or was not? He, the observer in the highest heaven, he alone knows, unless he knows not. Now, there's another passage, two more passages I want to read to you because I want to show you something that parallels something you know very well. Jung talks about two principles, logos and eros. Logos being identified with the masculine and eros being identified with the feminine, although we know that all of us have both logos and eros as part of our being. But at any rate, as Jung understood it, and perhaps in his time and place, it was more evident that logos, the word, the intellect, was more identified with the masculine principle, while eros, emotion, and relationship were more identified with the feminine. Now, this was probably not too original with Jung. I think he's perhaps indebted to maybe to the Rig Veda, maybe to Genesis. Because the word seems to be extremely important in the beginning with the word, and particularly the process of naming, which is the way in which we perceive elements of the self and then make them our own as we experience them through our personal ego. We give them a name, and that somehow nails them down. And you remember in Genesis 2:19, where the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called them, that was its name. Now, I read you the parallel in the Rig Veda. When, O Lord of the Word, the wise established name-giving, the first principle of language, that which was excellent in them, that which was pure, hidden deep within, through love was brought to light. When the wise created language with the mind, as if winnowing ground barley with a sieve, friends acknowledged the quality of friendship. Upon their speech was impressed the mark of grace. With devotion, they followed the path of the word, which they discovered dwelling within seers. They drew it out, ordering it in every way, the word over which the seven singers rejoice. Many a man who sees does not see the word, and many a man who hears does not hear it. Yet for another, it reveals itself like a radiant bride yielding to her husband. Another man is said to be uncaring. He has never moved to act courageously. All caught up in his futile imagining, the word he hears is without flower or fruit. He who forsakes the companion in knowledge has no way left open of sharing the word. Indeed, whatever he hears in vain. He knows nothing of the path of right action. And now I just want to read you the hymn of the sound of truth, which is more of the feminine aspect of the self expressed here. And you'll see the receptive quality in contrast to the word which goes out to have impact. The receptive quality holds and contains and conserves. I move with roaring, howling, and radiant might. I move with the infinite and nature's powers. I hold the love of the Lord of hosts. I hold the fire of the soul. I hold life and healing. I possess the sacred potion, and I wield the power to create, to nourish, and give. Indeed, I strengthen him who sacrifices, the mindful one, the generous, him who serves. I am queen, gatherer of abundance, knowing and wise, always supreme in worship. Divine powers appointed me in all places. I have many homes. I enter many forms. Through my power, the man of judgment may eat. And whoever breathes or hears the spoken word unknowingly, they all abide in me. In truth, I speak. Hear, O holy tradition. I alone utter the word of truth, the word that brings enjoyment to gods and men alike. The man I love, to him do I give power. I make him a divine, a seer, a sage. I stretch the bow of him who drives out evil, that the arrow may strike wisdom's enemy. I create among men strife and contention. I fill both the earth and heavens with my presence. In the beginning, I bring forth the Father. My source is in the waters ocean deep. From there I move out toward every creation, and with my stature I reach the sky above. I blow like the wind. It is I that maintain and I that sustain all things in creation, beyond the heavens and beyond this broad earth. Such is the magnitude that I have assumed. So now, these are a couple of images having to do with the self. I want to ask you if you want to pause and ask any questions or react again before we continue for a few more minutes. Okay, I think what I'd like to do is briefly talk about the doctrine of Taoism, because here again we have a concept of the Tao as the great ultimate, the very familiar image that's called the Tai Chi, and as we know so well, it's the one out of which, or within which, the opposites are united. They have not yet broken apart, and yin-yang comprise the Taoist basic image. It's not yin and yang, it's yin-yang. There is no yin without yang. There is no yang without yin. They cannot be separated. Yin referred originally to the shady side of the mountain, to the dark, to the moist, to the mysterious. Yang referred to the sunny side of the mountain, to the hot and the dry and the clear. Yang somehow seemed to have more to do with the part of time that is coming to or coming out of the night, and Yang very much is associated with the day and with high noon. Recently, I was in Montana and spent some time contemplating the mountains. It was a very beautiful setting that I was in, and there were high mountains all around, very green, the sky was very clear, the sun was very bright. And I got to thinking about yin-yang and the unity of the mountains, and I saw the mountains, the way I experienced them, were great. They were rather curved, and I could see the forms of a great reclining earth mother, tremendous, and then see, as you would watch various times of day, the shadows passing over so that what was yin at one time was yang at another, and what was yang became yin. And I had a profound sense of that unity that differs in its appearances, but underneath the appearances is always the same. The major work, the crucial work of Taoism is the Tao Te Ching, and there's a beautiful translation available now by Guy Fu Feng and Jane English. It's put out by Vintage Press, and again, it has a very lovely photograph to illustrate it. And there are a couple of passages that will give us a sense of the Taoist image of the self. This one, the first one, is one that's very familiar, and yet it carry such a wealth of meaning that I can't hear it too often. The Tao means the great ultimate, and it reads, the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the beginning of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of 10,000 things. Ever desireless, one can see the mystery. Ever desiring, one can see the manifestation. These two spring from the same source, but differ in name. This appears as darkness, darkness within darkness, the gate to all mystery. And then there's a beautiful illustration, if you can see it from here. It's like a gate between the rocks. And the Taoists were very deeply involved with nature, which they saw as part of the ongoing process of life in which they participated. And they went with it and felt themselves to be limited part of it and didn't want to create any dissonance with nature, but rather to put themselves into harmony with it. The Tao is an empty vessel. It is used, but never filled. O unfathomable source of 10,000 things, blunt the sharpness, untangle the knot, soften the glare, merge with the dust. O hidden deep, but ever present, I do not know from whence it comes. It is the forefather of emperors. Look, it cannot be seen. It is beyond form. Listen, it cannot be heard. It is beyond sound. Grasp, it cannot be held. It is intangible. These three are indefinable. Therefore, they are joined in one. From above, it is not bright. From below, it is not dark. An unbroken thread beyond description. It returns to nothingness, the form of the formless, the image of the imageless. It is called indefinable and beyond imagination. Stand before it, and there is no beginning. Follow it, and there is no end. Stay with the ancient Tao. Move with the present. Knowing the ancient beginning is the essence of Tao. Now, the question that Helen brought up that was so important is one that I wanted to touch on at this point. And I think I will do that, and then I think we'll take a break. And it's really a question that I'd like to put to you for your consideration. Why is the image of the self less prevalent in the Western world, particularly in, I should say, why is the archetype of the self less prevalent? So why is there less awareness of it in the West than it was in the East? We have monotheism. That's not the same as the self. The monotheistic God of the Hebraic tradition says, "Thou shalt have no other God before me," recognizing that there are lots of other gods and lots of people who are wanting to put them before Yahweh. So he is saying, "Thou shalt have no other God before me because I am the chief, the mighty one." So monotheism is not the same. Dualisms, like religions which have the power of good and the power of evil in a constant conflict, are not the same, and the Trinitarian concept is also somehow not the same as what we're talking about when we talk about the self. Why is this in the West? Anybody got some thoughts about that? Identify with right and wrong, good and evil. So there's a separation between God and human beings, and we somehow have to get to, or pray to, or reach out to, whereas in this concept of the self, we are already in the midst of it, and it is in the midst of us. Mm-hmm. Pardon, I couldn't quite hear you. Can you people hear? I can't hear. Would you mind speaking? Patriarchal Society, yes. Yes, by bringing the feminine into the divine principle, he achieves more of a wholeness, which suggests. Suggests an androgynous Godhead, which I think that these other religions seem to be much closer to, Taoism and Hinduism and Kabbalistic Judaism. Well, I would like to take a break, if you don't mind now. It's 25 after 3. Let's take about 10 minutes. But what about Jung's contribution to the psychology of the self? In his book, Ion, he deals at great length with Christ as a symbol of the self. Now, he makes the distinction not that Christ is the self, not that Christ is the symbol of the self, but Christ is a symbol of the self, which is to suggest that there might very well be other symbols of the self, and certainly we know from other religious expressions that there are. He refers a lot to Gnostic ideas, and he quotes the Gospel of St. Thomas, where Jesus is purported to have said, "If you bring forth that which is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." And this quotation suggests that the self is within, and that it is our responsibility to allow that to be expressed. Now, I ask myself whether we will, in the West, on any large scale, return to an awareness of the self. I was particularly interested in what Jung had to say about this very important, this overriding central archetype, the self, toward the end of his life. Jung's last book, last major work, was Mysterium Conjunctionis, the mysterious union. It's a very difficult book to read. I remember the first time I tried to read it, and I couldn't really make heads or tails out of it. It went on and on and on and on about things that I really didn't get a sense of where it was going, and I asked my analyst at the time what he made of it, and he said, "Well, I don't make much of it either, but I just dipped in every once in a while and read it. It's not a book you read through from start to finish." But I wanted particularly to see what Jung felt at the end of his life about the self. And so I went back to it, and this time I, instead of trying to understand it and read it, I scanned it more, and I began to understand how it was put together. He starts out, and I'm just going to read you the first paragraph. Yeah. What it is a beginning presentation of the components of the conjunctio. A Jung is a believer in polarities. He stresses polarities everywhere. Now, what is a polarity? Polarity is different from a dualism where there are two things side by side. It's certainly different from a pluralism. Polarity talks about opposite ends of a pole. Now, polarity is not a dualistic concept because there is only one pole, and there is a continuum between. So that when we talk about polar concepts, remember that we're not talking about separate things. We're not talking about yin and yang. We're talking about yin-yang. All right. He starts out this great huge book of over 600 pages as follows. Chapter 1, Components of the Conjunctio, Part 1, The Opposites. The factors which come together in the conjunctio are conceived as opposites, either confronting one another in enmity or attracting one another in love. You notice he says conceived. He doesn't say they are opposites. He says that they are conceived as opposites. To begin with, they form a dualism. For instance, the opposites are humidum, moist, secum, dry. I will skip the Latin, which he gives you a Latin term for every one of them, and we'll just do this in English. Cold, warm, upper or higher and lower, spirit, soul on the one hand and body on the other, heaven and earth, fire and water, bright and dark, active and passive, volatile and solid, volatile or gaseous and solid, precious, costly or vile, cheap or common, good and evil, open and occult or hidden, east and west, living and dead or inert, masculine and feminine, sol and luna. Often the polarity is arranged as a quaternio or quaternity, with the two opposites crossing one another, as, for instance, the four elements or four qualities, moist, dry, cold, and warm, as an emblem of the four elements and symbol of the sublunary physical world. This fourfold physis, the cross, also appears in the signs for Earth, Venus, Mercury, Saturn, and Jupiter. Okay. Now, for the next 456 pages, he continues to elaborate this theme. He goes through the opposites, all the alchemical opposites. He goes through every chemical you ever heard of and some you didn't. He goes through Rex and Regina, which has to do with all the king-queen archetypes in every way that they might possibly appear. He has a whole section on Adam and Eve and all the images and ramifications of that, and only in the last chapter of this final major work does he get around to dealing with the conjunctio, which is 100 pages long or less. Some of the symbols of the conjunctio are the alchemical marriage, that is the marriage of the material substances which symbolize or represent the spiritual combinations. The Hieros Gamos, which is again a sacred marriage, which may have to do more with images of the gods. And out of these sacred marriages come the one, the whole, quintessence, somebody mentioned, out of the four, you get two pairs of opposites. For example, in a human marriage, it would be the man and his anima and the woman and her animus. So the quaternity, the four, combine, and out of this, the fifth or the quintessence is produced. And that is that can be seen as the image of the divine child, then there's a myth built about the divine child. The divine child could be a Krishna or a Moses or Jesus or Oedipus. It's usually a child who's born in some very peculiar, strange circumstances and taken away from parents at birth or has a kind of mysterious childhood that people don't know just what happened and then comes back to fulfill a manifest destiny. So this is a symbol of the product of the union of the opposites. In alchemy, it was the lapis, or the philosopher's stone, or the Silius Philosophorus, the son of the philosopher. These were all archetypal images which run through the mythology of the relationship. Now, in the alchemical process, the process of coming to the conjunctio, the conjunction, there are several stages that Jung deals with. And I'm only going to name them and not go into them. This is part of the 100 pages of the conjunction. And it's kind of esoteric. It's mostly taken from alchemical literature, and he tells us what the alchemists, like Albertus Magnus and Dorn and some of those people, talked about. But the first stage is the negredo, the darkness or the chaos. And that is when the psychological parallel to that is the ego coming to terms with the shadow, coming to terms with its own unconscious background, with all the difficult and murky material from his own life. The second part, the stage of the process leading toward the conjunctio, is called the unio mentalis. I don't know if you want this. I'll put it up for you. And what that's all about is the union of spirit and soul. That's the coming to terms with the unconscious. And that's where the anima and animus would be recognized and dealt with. And finally, when they have become somehow integrated, if that ever happens, the goal would be the production of the lapis. The alchemical goal would be achieved. But then there has to be still another step, which is the union of the spirit with material reality. And that means the union of the spirit and the body. And we begin then to get a sense that it isn't sufficient to go through an inner process, but that the body and the analog of the body, the material world, also has to come into play. So that the last stage would be represented by the unus mundus. Unus meaning one and mundus meaning world. So that there is one world in the sense of the thing is simple. It is, yet simple things are always the most difficult. And so the one world which is simple, which is complete, which is not at war with itself, is the ultimate goal of the process. Now, at the end of the Mysterium Conjunctionis, after he has delineated the process of how the opposites unite, I just saved you reading 552 pages. I'm going to tell you how it comes out, okay? He talks about the union of the opposites and the sense of oneness and wholeness that comes out finally, or that actually we never really achieve it, but it's more of a direction, a movement in which we're going or feeling ourselves fulfilling, becoming aware of, entering into consciously. And now he stands back and looks at his work. And remember, this is his last work. And he says, truth and error lie so close together and often look so confusingly alike that nobody in his right senses could afford not to doubt the things that happened to him in the possessed state. 1 John 4:1 admonishes us, beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. This warning was uttered at a time when there was plenty of opportunity to observe exceptional psychic states. Although, as then, we think we possess sure criteria of distinction, The rightness of this conviction must nevertheless be called into question, for no human judgment can claim to be infallible. Now, what he's talking about here, I should really backtrack a little bit to give you some background. He says, we believe, this is on page 551 of Mysterium Conjunctionis, we believe that we can make assertions about God, define him, form an opinion about him, differentiate him as the only one true amongst other gods. The realization might by this time be dawning that when we talk of God or gods, we are speaking of debatable images from the psychoid realm. The existence of a transcendent reality is indeed evident in itself, but it is uncommonly difficult for our consciousness to construct intellectual models which would give a graphic description of the reality we have perceived. Let's see where he's coming from now. He's coming from the scientific method, from being a medical person, and trying to make a leap. Our hypotheses are uncertain and groping, and nothing offers us the assurance that they may ultimately prove correct. That the world inside and outside ourselves rests on a transcendental background is as certain as our own existence. But it is equally certain that the direct perception of the archetypal world inside us is just as doubtfully correct as that of the physical world outside us. If we are convinced that we know the ultimate truth concerning metaphysical things, this means nothing more than that archetypal images have taken possession of our powers of thought and feeling, so that they lose their quality as functions at our disposal. Now, it's really kind of interesting that he looks back on his work and makes this kind of a statement. And then he goes on to say what I read to you before about the warning about being possessed, about possession. Although we think we possess sure criteria of distinction, the rightness of this conviction must nevertheless be called into question, for no human judgment can claim to be infallible. In view of, and I read the last couple of sentences now, in view of this extremely uncertain situation, it seems to me very much more cautious and reasonable to take cognizance of the fact that there is not only a psychic but also a psychoid unconscious before presuming to pronounce metaphysical judgments which are incommensurable with human reason. You get that, or should I reread it? Okay. In view of this extremely uncertain situation, it seems to me very much more cautious and reasonable to take cognizance of the fact that there is not only a psychic, but also a psychoid unconscious. Now, by psychic unconscious, he means something that we perceive to be unconscious, that the ego recognizes as unconscious. And by psychoid, that means outside of our personal psyche. That's a kind of objective unconscious. Okay? To take cognizance of the fact that there is not only a psychic, but a psychoid unconscious before presuming to pronounce metaphysical judgments which are incommensurable with human reason. There is no need to fear that the inner experience will thereby be deprived of its reality and vitality. No experience is prevented from happening by a somewhat more cautious and modest attitude. On the contrary. So that's where he comes to finally. His caution in speaking of the self, of the Godhead behind the individual God images, and his ultimate reliance on reason and his hesitancy to take a leap beyond. Now, my own belief is that Jung was on the threshold of a higher consciousness. He was born in the end of the last century. He came to manhood and began his psychiatric work around 1900, which was a very vital time. It was, 20 years after Freud started, and this is the year that Max Planck developed the quantum hypothesis that started off the whole new physics. It was the time that Einstein was in Switzerland, and Jung knew Einstein and talked with him. It was the time that he was beginning to meet Freud and then separate from him, and recognize in Freud's atheism something that he couldn't quite accept. So Jung was in the midst of this tremendously tumultuous intellectual climate, and he was looking beyond like a man, like Moses on Mount Sinai, that he had come through this travail, and the promised land was in sight, but I don't think he was quite able to go over into it, and I don't think that many Westerners were at that time, although subsequently it has changed considerably. I remember Joshua being sent over to spy out and see what was in the Promised Land. Well, Jung similarly had contact with Richard Wilhelm, who brought in the Secret of the Golden Flower and the I Ching and other Oriental literature, and Jung looked at it, and he didn't quite know what to make of it. He wrote prefaces, but he didn't get thoroughly immersed in those. He was interested in Kundalini Yoga, which at that time was very mysterious. And I remember when I was at the Jung Institute still in 1960 that books on Kundalini Yoga were kept under lock and key. Today they're in every New Age bookstore. But there was a tremendous power there. And Jung, by daring to look at it, was far, far ahead of his time, and yet he did not take that leap. He warned, he gave a seminar on Kundalini Yoga, and he was very careful in warning people to look at it from a distance and not to think that they could get involved, that the Western mind wasn't capable of absorbing that. He was rather hesitant about meditation, about even Hatha Yoga. He was quite hesitant about the capacity of the Westerner to assimilate what he perceived as very powerful forces. Now, I want to turn to another book which has just come out. This is Ken Wilber's book, The Atman Project. It's a very heavy book. The subtitle is A Transpersonal View of Human Development. And I don't know how much you all know about the transpersonal movement in psychology, but it's beginning to strengthen itself, and it calls itself the fourth force, I guess, after the Freudian and the behavioral school and the humanistic school. Now comes the transpersonal school, which deals with the relationship of human concerns and ultimate concerns, and is developing psychotherapy to deal with people who are involved in those kinds of issues as primary concerns. Now, Ken Wilber has looked at the process of individuation and psychological development from the very beginnings of uterine development, intrauterine development, all the way to transcendent and transpersonal development. And he talks about an outward arc and an inward arc. The outward arc meaning the period in life in which we begin in a state of pleroma, and in a moment I'll explain what that is, and we move out into the world and we make our adaptations and we find out how to live a life and how to get along with people and how to be successful and fulfilled in the work that we've chosen. And then there is another whole dimension of life that happens to people when they have accomplished the first and then want to go on and feel that there is still something beyond that. And that's where the transpersonal comes in. Now, he talks about stages, and he names them. The first stage is the pleroma stage, which is really embryonic. It's oceanic, timeless. It's unconditional, and it could be likened to what Jung talks about as prima materia. Everything is present in potentia as the embryo develops. there is everything it needs to develop present there, with the exception of what will be added to it from the external world as time goes on. But the coding, the potential coding, is already there, and yet it's so chaotic and shapeless that there is no consciousness. Then comes the next stage, which is the uroboric stage. And you remember the image of the uroboros. Which is a serpent biting its tail. There is an organism, but it's somehow locked in an infantile maternal fusion. It's not separated. It's not differentiated. It's more vegetal. It's more, again, it has taken form, but it has not yet found out how it can function. And then comes the typhonic stage, named after the last child of Mother Earth in Greek mythology. And the Typhon, as you remember, was a 100-headed monster, a horrible snake-like creature with 100 heads and I don't know how many tails, and breathed fire and was extremely devouring. He even threatened Zeus and would have taken over Olympus if not Zeus had finally bested him in a struggle and threw him down a little to the west of Rome and set Mount Etna on top of him. And from the rumblings of Mount Etna and occasional eruptions, we realize that he's still down there, and I guess he's still somewhere within us too. But what is this psychologically, this typhonic stage? Well, it's a stage of very elementary object relations, people relating to others in the world in terms of getting something out of them, devouring what they have, the Freudian wish gratification, need or demand, the pleasure principle, the elementary emotions are all part of the typhonic stage, rage and fear and tensions and appetites of various kinds, the demand for satisfaction, for immediate gratification. There is no time sense. Everything has got to be right now, in the present. It's a pre-logical stage. It's I want and give me or I'm going to get. And this is the period mostly of very early childhood. It's also a magical period. It's beyond the paradise of the Pleroma stage, but it's still, there's a belief in magic and possibility, all sorts of possibilities that have nothing to do with reason or limits. And then as consciousness develops, the person moves to the what is called the verbal membership stage. And at this stage, mental and conceptual functions begin to emerge out of the ego, out of the body ego. Before it was all body, and now mental functions are beginning to happen. Language begins to structure present and future, because when you have language, you can step away from things and talk about them. It's not just a matter of grabbing and taking and having right now. So present and future awareness begins to come, and as name and word begin to be a part of human development. And this stage, this verbal membership self, where people can have some sort of relationship, marks the beginning of transcending instinctual demand. And then the human development continues to a mental or egoic self, which is a thought self. There's a self-concept begins to develop. One begins to perceive something other than the most elementary words and names. There begins now an internal differentiation of an ego structure. And there's where you get relationships now between parent and child, or between a superego and a kind of lower ego or infra ego. You get an ego shadow relationship, and then you get also the persona, which is a sort of fraudulent ego. And here's where you have dialogic thinking, and you get the beginnings of willpower and self-control, self-esteem, and the linear historical self is extended. So in these stages, the person is undergoing successive transformations, and these transformations operate through symbols. There are symbols which mark each of them, the symbols by which some of them are named, and the processes are accompanied by visual elements which move it along, which give us a sense of where we've been and where we're going. So this is primarily the outward arc, which is a growth from a kind of unconscious or subconsciousness to a consciousness of oneself with a small s as ego. Now, before I go on, I would like to see if anybody needs or wants to ask anything or comment. I know this is kind of heavy, but it is a very important concept of how the chain of understanding which originated with Jung develops and goes beyond Jung. We come then to the stage which Ken Wilber called centauric, after the centaur, which is a fusion of the body as represented by the horse and the mind, which is represented by the upper torso of the man and the symbol, the centaur. Now, the mature centaur is a kind of total body-mind. It's the point where the body and ego begin to go into a differentiation and higher order integration. Body and mind were once differentiated, and we talked about, somebody mentioned the Cartesian dualism. We're going now beyond that and bringing body and mind together, but on a very different level. It's not like the infantile fusion of body and mind where there was no consciousness, but this is a differentiated and then brought back together again in a very conscious way as a total body-mind. Now, on this level, the centaur is transverbal. That is, it's able to think in abstractions that go beyond words. It's able to experience feelings and emotions which transcend language and gross concepts and a kind of gross ego sense of self. And yet it doesn't it's not yet transpersonal. It doesn't transcend existence or personal orientation, that is a sense of being right here, right now, in this world, in this life. It doesn't transcend that. It doesn't transcend waking psychological awareness. Now, in this centauric stage, we can be very much in touch with our dreams, but we are in touch with our dreams as waking people are in touch with their memory of the dream. It's not a different state of consciousness or psychological awareness. So this is then the last stage, which is dominated by normal forms of space and time. We begin to recognize that space and time are important to our lives, and we also recognize that there's a possibility of seeing space and time in very different ways. But the forms are still there, and we still have them in the forefront of our consciousness. Now this is, I believe, where Jung left us at the end of Mysterium Conjunctionis. Jung, as perhaps the highest development of the centauric, is grounded in the present, in reason, and still aware of linear time. He's poised as the transition between the higher, subtler, and transpersonal stages of development. So now, what's that all about? What is there beyond the place to which Jung has left us, to the pinnacle of Mount Sinai? Well, Wilbur talks about the truly transpersonal realms of being. And he says that we begin by looking at them as Jung did, through intuition, through intentionality, and through vision images. That these are all intimations of the higher realms of transition and integration, but only visions. The self was before Jung existed, and after Jung, we continued to direct our awareness toward the self. So, let's go on. Wilbur talks about the subtle realm, and this, a lot of it comes from Eastern psychology and philosophy. He differentiates the subtle realm from the gross realms, saying that the gross realms deal with the traditional psychologies, with Jung on the far edge of it, particularly when he deals with the symbolic world of alchemy. The gross realms deal with levels of increasing differentiation and integration and come to the point of transcendence. In the gross realms, we focus on ordinary waking consciousness, the physical body, and ordinary space and time. Even though Jung pays a lot of attention to what's just beyond that, to dreams, to the soul, which certainly is more than the physical body, and to a timeless unconscious, the collective unconscious, having no space or time. So then there's a gross reflecting mind. The material intellect takes its present organization of consciousness for the limit of its possibilities. Now, this is a statement that's made by Aurobindo. The gross reflecting mind, the material intellect, takes its present organization of consciousness for the limit of its possibilities. How much we see this? People feel, when they've achieved a certain amount, be it much or little, that this is the limit of the possibilities. They've worked very hard to have these understandings, to come to a position, and they get to a certain point and they say, well, this is it. This is my platform. I'm going to run on it. Psychologically, we tend to do this. Religiously, we tend to do it. We find a place where we're comfortable, and that is the present organization of consciousness. It's a mind that's habituated only to the evidence of the senses. And you remember what Jung had said when we read that he's very careful about going beyond the evidence of the senses, and he talks about all the distortions that can occur, and are you going to hear the voice of the gods or the voice of the devils? But, you know, you better watch out for that stuff. And reality in this gross reflecting mind is associated with the corporeal fact, with what you can point to and establish and make hypotheses about and test and prove to be like that. But then, Wilbur asks, is this all there is? Or is consciousness continuing to evolve? And he made a statement which really impressed me quite a bit. He said, you know, if we human beings have evolved from amoeba, is it not conceivable that we can continue evolving from our present state and develop from human beings to participants in the consciousness of the self. I like that position. It doesn't seem to me to be impossible. I don't think we're going to see that happening for a long time, but I ask myself, what's the hurry? I did a workshop just a couple of weeks ago for about 22 people, and after we got done solving all the problems of the universe, we sat around and talked about how we were going to go and out in the world and let people know. And we thought about, we felt like voices crying in the wilderness, and then I happened to look up on the wall, and there was a picture of Jesus sitting at the Last Supper with 12 apostles, and I thought to myself, well, that was a pretty small group of people to go out and have impact on the world, and yet look what happened. So I can't help but feeling that however long it takes for psychological and spiritual development to come into being, that it's possible to move in that direction. And if it isn't fulfilled in our lifetime or our children's or our grandchildren's, it doesn't matter as long as we move in that direction. So then, we talk about the subtle realm. You all know what I'm talking about? Well, he's talking about areas of consciousness which are related to only symbolically with parts of the body. There are, in Kundalini Yoga, there are seven chakras, beginning with the one that's at the base of the spine, and the seventh one is at the top of the head, and that's the, each one represents a level of consciousness, which somehow correspond to, perhaps to these, roughly, and then there are two more. We're talking about the upper chakras, the upper centers of consciousness. The low subtle is the one that's associated with the third eye, the eye of intuition, the eye of psychic awareness. And in this subtle realm, there is a potentiality for out-of-body experiences, which incidentally Jung had one. If you read in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, when he was in danger of dying, you remember there is a narration of how he experienced himself up near the ceiling looking down at his body in the bed, and his consciousness had left his body. There's been a good deal of work done on people who have either almost died or been pronounced legally dead and have come back, and they experience, or they're described experiences where the consciousness had left the body and then returned to the body. Now, that happens sometimes in illness or in cases of extreme stress. That can occur to people, and most people who are open to that possibility know somebody who might have had that kind of experience. But in the subtle realm, it is not just something that occurs, happens willy-nilly when you're so sick that your ordinary consciousness is not functioning, or when you've had a great trauma, but that can be brought about through an opening to this consciousness, through spiritual, psychological development. This capacity to leave the gross body and to find some pathway out of it into a bodiless communion with the self. And it's, there's, so that one part of the subtle realm has to do with this out-of-body experience. The other one is the so-called psychic experience, or psi experience, the PSI, the Greek letter for psyche. And psi phenomena include precognition, that is, knowing that something is going to happen before it does, clairvoyance, being able to see something that's going on in a distant place, a psychokinesis, being able to move things around simply through psychological energy. Now, many individuals plug into this inadvertently. I think we all have had the experience of having a telephone ring and knowing who is on the other end of the line before you pick it up. And it's not a rational process. You don't sit down and think, well, so-and-so promised to call me at such and such a time, it must be he, but it may be somebody you had not expected at all, and somehow you hook into that thing. So that is part of psychic phenomena, but it happens with most of us as a, just inadvertently, just pops out. But in a transcendent consciousness, people can be very much in touch with that and able to call upon it, to develop their abilities. And so we talk about seers and people who are psychically gifted or highly intuitive people. And this is very different from this inadvertent popping up. It's really a natural extension of the transcendent function of consciousness. So that's the one that's associated with the third eye, symbolic of a particular type of inner knowing that intuition is only a kind of inadequate term for. There is still another realm that Wilbur talks about, which is associated with the highest chakra, the one at the crown of the head, which is represented by a lotus sometimes. And that has to do with the transcendent of all mental forms. It's above and prior to mind or ego, to prior to and above the world and body. It's something which, as Thomas Aquinas would have said, all men and women would call God. Can't say much about that because it's a stage that people much wiser than I are still working toward getting in touch with, but only that I have a sense of knowing that there are possibilities, and perhaps even having had some touch with people who perhaps have come relatively close to it. Now, I want to read you just a little piece from Ken Wilber, which might give you a sense of the concept of the self. And that's the last thing I'm going to read to you, and then I want to leave a little time free to talk together and to get some of your sense about it. He's just said, the intuition of that which is above and prior to mind, self, world, and body, something which, as Aquinas would have said, all men and women would call God. But this is not God as an ontological other set apart from the cosmos, from humans, and from creation at large. It is God as an archetypal summit of one's own consciousness. John Blofeld quotes someone on the Vajrayana viewpoint. It is the emptiness of everything which allows the identification to take place. The emptiness which is in us coming together with the emptiness which is the deity. By visualizing that identification, we actually do become the deity. The subject is identified with the object of faith. As is said, the worship, the worshiper, and the worshipped. These three are not separate. At its peak, the soul becomes one, literally one, with the deity form, with the Buddha, with God. One dissolves into deity as deity. That deity which from the beginning has been one's own self or highest archetype. In this way only could St. Clement say, that he who knows himself knows God. We could now say, he who knows his overself knows God. They are one and the same. Now, I've said a lot, and I don't know how much one can assimilate in a couple of hours or so. And I really haven't intended that you remember it or accept it. What I wanted to do in this final session of our intensive course on Jung's ideas, what I wanted to do is to touch you with this and possibly to pique your interest, some of your interest, some of your curiosity, to let you know where I've been, what I've been thinking about, and how I've been moving with Jung as a firm base, and a little sense of direction, perhaps, that you may or may not want to pursue. So that's where it is now. We're in it, we're of it. And our task, as I see it, is to allow our consciousness to go on developing, to allow it to go on evolving, so that we can, that the human race can somehow survive everything it's subject to and reach higher levels as the human has evolved out of far lower levels. Thank you. So now, perhaps we can have some conversation about it. Yes?
I've had your book and Anthology for some time, and I haven't begun to read it yet.
Well, how I organized androgyny to give you a pathway. The first part of the book, I tried to trace the ancient roots of androgyny, the parallels in various mythologies. Tried to describe what androgyny is, how I understand it. And the second part of it was to see where it's going. My ideas about androgyny are rather atypical. I don't see it in the way the Stanford research team sees it. I see it much more of an inner development with a historical base. But I relate it then in the second part to what we're beginning to know about the world we live in, how the scientific and the esoteric and Oriental religions are beginning to compare their insights and dialogue with one another, and how androgyny is a part of that. And then it goes on to suggest directions in which we can go and how we can live out the androgyny, which is a part of everybody's humanity. Yes?
How does it relate to the fact that the fact of the imagination to the development of these parallel realms?
Oh, I don't know that that in Jung's work he was intending that they be directly related. Well, I think that the question is how would we relate our active imagination to the development of these subtle realms and the capacity to deal with them. I think that in active imagination, one needs to maintain an ego position. It is a dialogue between ego and unconscious. And we come to a transcendent function which transcends both ego and unconscious theoretically. But the moment that you write out the dialogue that goes on, or paint the picture, or whatever, you're having to deal with material things, with pen and paper and ink and paint or whatever. And it seems to me that to transcend, one has to be able to let go and move beyond. I think active imagination is a good preparation because it begins to allow us to explore the unconscious. But it reminds me of William Blake in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. He, at one point, is looking down into the abyss where all the murky, mysterious, horrible spiders and ghastly creatures are cavorting around. But when he looks down, he has his foot firmly planted in the root of an oak tree. It seems to me active imagination is something like that. We have that ego right there ready to grab, to hold us from going off. And it seems to me that at some point, if we're going to move on, it's necessary to let go. Well, yeah, I wouldn't advise anybody here to try to suspend the ego completely. I think it takes a lot of preparation, and that if it's going to be done at all, one is better off beginning with a guide to provide that connection so that you can let go and you have someone that you trust and who is really knowledgeable, who can take responsibility for you if you're going to do that. Now, that's very true, but the experience and the understanding have to sort of play into each other. You reach a certain level of understanding, and then you experience something on that level, and you incorporate into your understanding, and you're no longer the same person you were when you understood that before, but you're reinforced or moved on, and then you begin to understand more, and then you're capable of having another kind of experience. So there's this constant interplay of knowledge and understanding and experience. Fully see that problem, and I'm glad to say that communities are developing, and groups are developing, networks are developing. Where there is this kind of awareness. And, yeah, I feel as you do, Philip, that the Sisygoths are about to descend. But when I was a little girl, I used to like to do manuscript writing, you know. I always just imagined myself going up to some little monastery in Switzerland and wasn't unlike the Jung Institute now that I think about it. And there I was going to write down all this worldly wisdom in manuscript so that when the Visigoths, you know, and the Goths came down, that it would be remembered. And I think that you know, maybe a lot of us have that kind of task to keep that alive. And if we don't write books about it, we can teach our children or our congregations or our students or our clients or whoever, or our friends and teachers, in rising consciousness going.
I wonder if enlarging consciousness also means going into the next, but I remember going out and saying that when we're off in the art group, and it just means drugs is like a rape of the mind and experience of psyche. And what happens is that can be absolutely terrifying and horrendous. I remember one of your quotes in one of your books, and you said that somehow preferentially should be the I watching the activity of the non-I. And I'm thinking of psychotically, which you describe that final nervous breakdown is usually the experience of an explosion. There's nothing to do with it. To the collective and you know, like the expansion of consciousness, we're looking at it almost in terms of like the higher kind of realms of the positive thing, but we know from other kinds of experiences before that it can be a kind of horrendous. Jung warns about that.
He certainly does.
Enormous.
And I myself am very resistant to
people getting involved in them unless, number one, they're prepared, and number two, they are very well guided. And it's very dangerous. Some people come through, but an awful lot of people break down in the process. I'm glad that you brought that up. Well, I think we better stop at this point because I want to give you a couple of minutes to fill out your sheets that Sharon.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.